WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. On March 1, 1954, a Puerto Rican nationalist named Lolita Lebron and three other protesters opened fire in the U.S. House of Representatives. Five members of Congress were wounded. 23 years later, Lebron's daughter, Gladys Mendez, committed suicide by throwing herself out of a moving car. Her 8-year-old daughter tried in vain to restrain her. That child, Irena Villar, tried to kill herself 10 years later while she was attending college in New York. This legacy of self-destruction is the subject of Irena Villar's new memoir, A Message from God in the Atomic Age. The title is taken from a prison letter her grandmother wrote to President Eisenhower. In the book, Villar explores the political and personal circumstances that led each of these women, including herself, to consider their own deaths. In trying to piece together her family's history, she said she ran into many stories about what had happened. I asked her for the version she heard about her grandmother and what she had done in the U.S. House.
At the beginning, when I didn't know much, I would have people tell me she was a terrorist, even friends who had their own specified ideas of what terrorism was. Others would just say that she was a martyr. Others would say she was a heroine. So it took me some time to realize she wasn't a terrorist, that terrorism is based on chaos and on fear and on unpredictability and the uncertainty of its origins. And she actually dressed up for the occasion, you know, she kind of draped herself in the Puerto Rican flag and went and faced what seemed to be the dress of power, the congressman.
So she went in with her friends. They sat in the gallery. Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
Then I believe they were about to take a vote. The congressmen were about to take a vote on a bill about letting farm workers from Mexico come in. And I believe they waited for that moment in which they stood up, the no's and yays. And at that moment, she stood up and put the flag around her body and just shouted, Viva Puerto Rico. And then her companions began to shoot, and she also began to shoot.
How many people were wounded?
Six. Well, many, but basically six were critically wounded.
And then because they stood up and made themselves very obvious, did the police, the guards descend on them?
Yes. It was so easy. It was like, you know, like going into a big trap. They just stood there and kept shooting and reloading. And at that moment, when people kind of, you know, the congressman heard, you know, Viva Mexico. Since the context was something else, or maybe Hollywood, I don't know. But it was a moment of great confusion from what I've researched and asked. But it took very little time for the guards to come in and just take over.
Now, what was her trial like? And she was, in the end, sentenced to more than 50 years in prison. Can you describe the trial for us?
57 years. There is one moment in which kind of summarizes her whole frame of mind and her disposition through that trial. And it was when she was going out of one of the first trials. She faced two of them, but the first one, a reporter asked her, how did she feel about her children? She had a girl, then a boy, my mother and my uncle, who was still alive. He died a few months after that. But anyway, she answered, it is painful now for them because they're children, but when they grow up, it would be more important for them to be free than to have a mother. And this is why I'm doing this now.
Did your grandmother ever say she regretted what she did?
Yes. She doesn't regret the years in prison. She doesn't regret the life she gave to the struggle, or what she sees as the struggle. She does regret the bloody part of it. She's a pacifist, and she's a very religious Catholic woman. And she lately has kind of directed her struggle into that more religious side of things.
I'm speaking with Irena Vilar, and her book is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. It's a memoir, the story of her grandmother, whom we've just been talking about, who opened fire in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1954, sentenced to prison, now lives in Puerto Rico, where she was born. The book is also about my guest's mother, who later committed suicide, and, of course, my guest herself, who has attempted suicide. Well, let's talk a little bit about your mother. Now, when she was born, your grandmother left her in Puerto Rico so that she could go to the United States. Why do you think she felt she couldn't take her own daughter with her?
I think she had a very ambivalent relationship to this baby because it was born out of not of a love relationship, but more out of a bartering relationship with a rich man that had kind of given them a home after her father had died. So it was a kind of, you know, kind of selling of, and this baby was very, very ambivalent for her. And I think she left it. She was young. She was only 20. And after she got to New York, then she became involved with the party. She wasn't involved before. She was just a writer. She was a poet. She had a very difficult life, very poor life in the countryside. And when she got to New York, she met people. She got involved with the seamstress in New York City, trying to organize them. She met very interesting people that directed her that were struggling then in New York City. And little by little, I think that abandonment became justified in other ways. But I think the origins of that leaving my mother was much more complex and much more, perhaps, for her, shameful to admit. But I think it's very rich, yeah.
Who took care of your mother?
Her grandmother. My grandmother's mother.
So your great-grandmother.
Exactly.
Then raised your mother.
Yes.
You mentioned the word abandonment, which, of course, is a very strong word. Do you feel, then, that your grandmother abandoned your mother?
I don't necessarily feel that, but I know that's the way my mother felt. I know that from the things I witnessed through her, through the melancholy she had, and through her efforts to justify that, through her own involvement in the party, through trying to free her and work with people back in Puerto Rico to build support to free her mother. But basically, deep inside, there was a sense of abandonment.
Well, you're the youngest of four children, the only daughter. What kind of mother was she to you?
She was a very... she was marvelous. She was very sweet. We were together constantly, always. I was more than a daughter. I was a witness because I went everywhere with her. And I was also her shield, you know, when she had her own affairs. I was her shield. So I was many things for her. But towards me, I got a lot of love, but a lot of ambiguities, too.
Well, I want to have you read a section from your memoir, and this is actually written about leaving your brother's wedding. And at the wedding, your father had been dancing with a younger woman, and the year is 1977. Can you read that section for us?
Uh-huh. It goes, "My brother Cheito's wedding was anything but heaven for Mama. So long, Papa said, getting in behind the wheel. Uncle Miguel didn't take his eyes off Mama. Drive carefully, he said. Take it easy, he's stressed. Papa, with his usual optimism, declared that everything was going to be all right. He started the engine and we took off in the Mazda. We were returning home on the 27th of February, 1977. I don't know if they said anything to each other. Mama stayed in the same position, maintaining the same silence with which she'd gotten in, and I, who'd seen Uncle Miguel's worried face, was keeping watch in the back seat, sort of preparing myself for what was to come. In the shadows of the car, all I could see of her was the gold purse. She was clutching it with both hands. Papa was looking straight ahead. He was still looking ahead when we went through the main gate, and that's how he was during the whole trip, straight ahead. As if there was still time to stop everything, I look back. I look for the church where my brother had just gotten married, and I saw Uncle Miguel still standing there with the undecided expression of someone who knows that something is going to happen. Was he imagining it? I've got to look after her, I said to myself, and I took her arm firmly as if to tell her I wouldn't abandon her. She turned around. She had the look of someone who was very tired. I let go, but from my back seat, I kept on watching her. Her eyes were enlarged, empty. Go to sleep, she ordered. It was the last thing she ever said to me.
Both you and your uncle had this idea of something was going to happen next. And what happened was that she threw herself out of the car. Both you and your father then took her to the hospital. Her head was on your lap, and she died. You write, she'd done what she wanted to do. She left me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you felt? That she had, that this was a personal thing, that she had left you?
I think that, that in that section, the point of view is more the point of view of the child,
right,
which the whole world centers around that mother, and who for whom she's sacred. She's God. I mean, that child has no idea of religion or of God beyond that mother.
When the police investigated the accident, you said that she'd fallen asleep against the door, which opened. Did you feel you wanted to protect your mother?
Yes. You know, many times I've asked myself why I so spontaneously came up with that lie, and probably I think that as a child, even within my ignorance, I knew that what happened was wrong, and I tried to make it look fine. I tried to make it again all right, and it was not only my mother, but my father. I sensed somehow, too, that my father was part of it and that it was directed towards my father. So, and I loved dearly my father, so I also wanted to protect him.
Well, Irina Vilar, we're going to take a very short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Irina Vilar. Her book is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. And it's a memoir of three generations of her family. Her grandmother opened fire in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1954 and was sentenced to 57 years of prison. She served 29 of those years. Her mother committed suicide when my guest was a little girl. And my guest, Irina Vilar, attempted suicide several times. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Irina Vilar, and her book is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. When do you think you became unglued, if I can use that word? And I want to have you actually read a section from the book after we hear the answer to that. But when you look back over your life then, do you have a clue about when things started to go wrong for you?
Yes, I think they had started to go wrong for a long time. I think that as a child, when my mother died and kind of desacralized my life, I had enough good things inside, thanks to some luck I had by having all these uncles and aunts and my father. I was a lucky child, I think, in many ways, that somehow were able to make me just keep going. But I did it by just kind of forgetting. I mean, I did it more, I don't know how you say, mourn?
Mourn, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mourn, yeah, mourn. I didn't mourn. It was just like, she died, okay, I'll just fix the house and start from scratch. And that, I think that helped me for a long time because the horror of that experience, and that's part of the trauma, just, you know, it was too horrifying. And it helped me to keep going. But then at age 18, that technique, you know, doesn't help you anymore because the problems are different. And I think that when I became a senior and many things started to coincide, also I was coming of age and I was starting to be a woman. I was making love. I was knowing what a body is in many other ways. So a lot of things started to coincide and my mother became a recourse.
Well, I want to have you read another section from the book, and this is something that you write about a time you were 18 years old, and it's in the middle of winter.
Mm-hmm. I'd just moved into a house on Buckingham Street, and that day I'd begun to fix the place up. I'd stopped going to my literature classes. On Sunday, January 31st, I opened the boxes and found Mama's picture. It was the last photograph taken of her. I'd carried that picture with me ever since I was a little girl. Everything, sadness, death, and even the chipness of the metal frame informed that photograph and its absurd proportions. I wanted to hang it on one of the walls. After all, that woman of clear beauty was my mother. I could hear the rain beating on the roof of the balcony, and I could also hear my mother's voice in the sound of the rain, and something in my blood made the connection, and while I was standing on a chair, struggling to straighten out the picture, my mother's voice persisted. I shouldn't have been hearing that voice. Things hadn't been going well for me lately, and the refuge I needed was somewhere else. Perhaps in my index cards. I had been shuttling between the library and my room, armed with index cards that were becoming increasingly oppressive. But Mama's overpowering voice went on. Hundreds of voices sprang from hers, talked among themselves, spoke to me, about me, on my behalf, voices from my index cards, the illusion of a busy life. Notes for a diary I would one day turn into a critical book about three sirens or cycles, the child, the nymph, the old lady, three generations of women in my family. But what I imagined was a clever project was fast becoming a chaos of 3x5 cards I couldn't bother to read because they brimmed with pride, wanton self-assertiveness, self-conscious family epigrams, too glorious to be taken seriously now that I could barely stand on my own feet. As I stepped down from the chair, the other voices faded away, but Mama's went on. It started to invade me, to get inside me. It said, "Hurry up, Irene. You can only be one of us."
You took a mixture of pills and vodka, and you described that early sensation of suicide, really, as a kind of vertigo. Do you remember the sensations, the feelings of what it was like when the pills and the vodka took effect?
Yes, there is so much that gets mixed with those images because there's also images that are yours, but there are also images that come from so many places, from movies, from TV, from books. And they all get mixed up, giving you even more the feeling that you're nothing, that you're a fake, that even your own death is not yours, you know? So I do recall that feeling nothing all the way to the end, feeling that not even that act was mine, that even that act was a reenactment. And basically, it was a reenactment. It was a repetition of my mother's act.
You talked about the fact that these index cards that you were keeping as a way of I guess, writing down the facts of your life, that in part these were the words and memories that were driving you crazy. And yet here you've written a book, drawn, I assume, to some degree on these index cards that you kept. Was there something about being able to finally write this story down which helped you bring some kind of order and sanity to your life?
Yes, very much, the book. I always wrote in bits and pieces. I until that moment, that critical moment in my life, writing was more undirected. I kind of lacked an organizing principle. I lacked organization and purpose. So this crisis and all that happened in it and after it gave me a wound where to write from, basically. I knew where the wound was, and I knew that it could give me a lot of material to organize those cards. And that not only was my story, but it was the story of these other two characters, and that through them, many other stories could also be told. So it's a memoir, but it's more than a memoir, it's a testimony, because it's a point of view of the witness.
Well, you say that that your mother's death may be your redemption. Are you any more certain today after you wrote those words?
Yes, I mean, to the extent. I mean, the phrase itself has the price of poeticity, but you know, as there is a part of it that is very truth, which is that she offered me an image of fragility and of loss that I feel privileged to have, you know. Many people go through their lives with nothing more lacking than not having seen the basketball game the day before. I don't know to what extent that redeems you or not. So I think that, I mean, it's just out there for questioning.
Well, Irene Villar, I thank you very much for joining us today in Fresh Air. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Irene Villar's memoir is called A Message from God in the Atomic Age. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.